Welcome back, everyone. This is Eric Ellison. Today I'm with my friend and fellow case fellow, Stephen Levy, who was recognized as Massachusetts Teacher of the Year in 1993, honored by the Disney American Teacher Awards as the National Outstanding General Elementary Teacher in 1995, was the recipient of the Joe Oakey Award for his national impact on project-based learning, and received the John F. Kennedy Prize for the Teaching of History. I share that because that's some of the questions that I want to ask him today. But he's also been a fourth grade teacher where his students designed and were honored with as conservation heroes by the National Park Service for their study of the effects of a local bike path on the environment and the community. Mr. Levy has, and Stephen has written various articles for education journals, and his book, Starting from Scratch, which we read while I was at Boston University. So it's always fun to kind of make the connections. Yeah. Details some of the projects and students he has worked with in his elementary classroom. So Stephen, thank you for joining me in this conversation today. And just the first question, in your article, Power of Audience, you say, when student work culminates in a genuine product for an authentic audience, it makes a world of difference. I don't know about you, but in my teacher prep program, that was not something that we talked or trained ourselves quite a bit in. If it was for you, how is that different? But if it wasn't, when did you come to this realization, and how did that transformation just, you know, come about in your own classroom?
Well, good morning, Eric. Thank you. I love the format of your blog or podcast or however this will come out, but I like it framed as a conversation, and I'm delighted to jump into that with you. The idea of audience is just so critical in terms of student motivation, first of all. So if you try to think, why is it that your students do the work that you require of them to do? And often the first answer is, well, to get a grade, or maybe to advance to the next level of whatever it is that I'm studying. But the idea of audience, if I'm producing this work, and it's not just for my teacher, but that somebody in the world cares about it, somebody beyond my teacher and even beyond my parents, that just fills me with a desire to want to do my best work. If I don't have that authentic audience that, for example, a musician knows and their hard practicing is always because they know there's going to be an audience, they're going to be able to perform. Anybody in any sport knows the reason they put in hours and hours and hours of practice to do their best is there's going to be a game. But there isn't anything equivalently academically. So I guess the equivalent is just, again, my grade, moving on to the next level. So if I'm working for a grade, then the motivation is extrinsic. And basically, as a teacher, I've got B.F. Skinner's toolbox to motivate them to do the work. I bribe them, I threaten them in all manner of subtle ways. And I'm trying to create a culture where the kids are doing the work because the work matters and because they love what they're doing, and they have to do a good job because it matters to the world. It contributes to making a better world. So this idea of audience is the most powerful, I think the most powerful component of turning curriculum from this extrinsically grade motivated process to something I do because I care about making a better world and changing people's lives.
So what was that? When did you come to that realization or that flip in your own teaching that kind of allowed you to walk into these places, and especially, you know, with this bike path project?
Yeah. Well, I think I started with much smaller projects, a bike path project we spent the entire year on. And so I think just the tasting the enthusiasm of students when they were working for something that mattered, and seeing how motivated they were, seeing how much they cared with a simple thing like I think one of the first projects I did was trying to figure out where a loaf of bread came from. And it was actually my class was misbehaving terribly with a student teacher who was trying to do a writing lesson with them. And they were, you may have done it, where you have to write the directions for making a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And so kids write the directions, they exchange their directions with each other, and then they try to employ the directions they got. And kids are spreading peanut butter on their desk, and then finally I'm sitting there on my hands, you know, do I interrupt and try to save this student teacher or let her? And finally then I see a piece of bread go flying across the room, and I just couldn't stand it anymore, and I just jumped up and I said, and I'm thinking, these kids, you know, you just have no respect, you're throwing food around and people are starving in the world, and you are so I just jumped up, I held the loaf of bread up, I said, does anybody know where this comes from? And so the kids are like, well, Stop and Shop, Star Market? I said, no, I mean, really, like all that had to go into this bread and you're just throwing it around? You're going to find out. So a lot of times the project just begins out of some authentic need that arose in the classroom. And then the journey of figuring out where that loaf of bread comes from the writing of two farmers in Kansas, to getting wheat that they send us ourselves, to planting it ourselves, to taking it through the whole process grinding and threshing and all the different steps it takes before making a loaf of bread. And always the challenge in projects like that is how do you connect it to the curriculum you have to teach? So
let me ask a question about that, because, you know, oftentimes we get into these places in education where standards, the curriculum drives us, and then we try to inauthentically, or we try to shove in these projects, or we try to shove things in. And then when people hear you talk about a year-long project, like the bike path project, how did you kind of say, okay, how does this all fit? How does it actually all connect to this process of learning, to the process of authentic learning? And how does it just bring the learning alive rather than trying to hodgepodge pieces together?
Yeah, such a great question and such an important one. I think when I started, particularly more working with teachers and designing projects had a pretty fluffy reputation. And rightly so, because they often tended to be more like a dessert after we study from the textbook and lectures and everything else. Now we'll do a project. And so we've just read all about ancient Egypt, and now the project is we're going to make a pyramid out of sugar cubes. And we're going to spend weeks, you know, beautifully putting them together. We'll make these great displays and people will come in. Which is a great project, and I'm not saying it's not terrifically engaging, but they don't learn anything really in that whole process. So how do you get the project to be more the main course rather than the dessert after your study? So I think the first thing I think about in starting a project is how am I going to get, are there ways that this project is going to take me to the main topics that I know I have to teach? And I particularly think about science and social studies, because pretty much anything you can read and write, engage those disciplines authentically. But I have to make sure I can get to simple machines or rocks and minerals or colonial history or whatever those big topics are in science and social studies.
So when you think about, when you reflect back on the Bike Path Project in particular, as it's the 25th anniversary of this, and I know you've shared with me that there may be some celebrations coming up or some of those types of things. But, you know, when you reflect on it, what was that experience like? Because it was such a large experience, as a year-long experience, that it was so meaningful to not just the students, but to your work and to the community. Like, how do you reflect on that, and how does that inspire you, you know, as you even move forward with your work as a consultant and, you know, school trainer?
Great. Yeah, we're very excited about the 25th anniversary. And the town is actually planning sort of a revisiting of the origins of the bike path. And they accidentally came across the book my kids wrote, which was in our library. And they contacted me and said, we want to republish the book and we want to have, and we're thinking even of bringing the kids back for a reunion, who are, I'm sure, all over the country now, but I've been in touch with a couple of them and they're excited about the idea. Let me say one word generally about the project, and then I'll tie that to the bike path. But the most helpful metaphor for me in trying to conceive of what this project does is it's like a river. And the way a river connects different cities and different ports and is what the project does. And you, if you imagine this bike path and the river went through the whole year. But again, as I say, I have to know where the topics are that I need to dive more deeply into, because I don't want to sacrifice content in any area because I'm trying to integrate them. So the river goes along we get to Simple Machine, and I know I have to. So we get to the city of Simple Machines. And I'm going to get off my boat of the river, which is the project, and I'm going to go dive into all that I've created, all the experiments, all the readings, everything I've got and have always done around Simple Machines. So in that way, the river carries me authentically, but then I'm going to get off and go deeply into the content. So when we're doing wheat, it's going to be when we're grinding the wheat, and they first try to grind the berries with a rock. And it's pretty exciting to see those hard berries turn into this little flower. But after 20 minutes, they have, you know, like a thimble of flour, and they're frustrated. And then the next day, I bring in the grinder, the hand grinder, and they grind, and it's amazing. And they're so excited that they can do this so efficiently, which sort of leads to the question, what is it about the grinder that makes it so much more efficient than when you were using the rock? And we take the grinder apart, and there's a wedge, and there's a screw, and there's a lever, and it sort of opens the door then to the world of Simple Machines, and now I'm going to get off the river and just do all my Simple Machine experiments. If I'm studying the bicycle, it's going to be the river now is this sort of bicycle and how it works, and when we get to Simple Machine Village, how the bicycle works, and we take it apart and see those Simple Machines, and I'll still go then and do the same kind of activities with them around Simple Machines. Or if we're building something, one year we built our own desks, and then it was the tools that we used. So when we get to the tools, we get off the project and go do all my Simple Machine work. So the river then goes down until we get to the place where I have to study colonial life or something in social studies. And in the same way, we'll get off the river then and do the more traditional, real content building, knowledge building work, but connected in this authentic way with the project, which is this idea of the river. So the bike path, right, I know I have to get to Simple Machines. I have to get to rocks and minerals. So Simple Machines is pretty obvious through the bike path, through the bicycle itself, and just the history of the bicycle. From the first bicycle was actually a hobby horse that you sat on and pushed along with your legs, and to see the journey of that into the pedal. And then you had the giant front wheel and the tiny, and then the even wheels and the chain, just the whole story of the technology of the inventions that made the bicycle more efficient and more safe and faster, was amazing story of how humankind has employed the use of these machines to make our work more efficient. Our colonial life, the place where the bike path runs used to be a railroad, and before that was a canal. So just studying the history sort of got me back to why did they need a railroad? What was the canal for? And that again, sort of, now I'm going to get a little bit off the bike path and spend my 3 weeks deeply into the content of colonial life here that, again, are right up the alley of my standards and what I have to teach. So that's what I have to see before I start a project. And I don't necessarily have to have it all planned out, but I have to see, okay, here's how I'm going to get to my main content. Rocks and minerals, we actually got to through the analysis of what is pavement and where does it come from? And that sort of, again, was this sort of place where I could get off and then really look at the whole history of rocks and minerals and how it eventually became asphalt.
So Stephen, let me ask this question, and I don't think it was, you know, something I was planning to ask, but I think it goes with inspiration, motivation. Like, as a teacher, like, we get into the grind and the busyness, and just even my times talking with you, you are intrigued, you're interested, you're a learner, you know, but oftentimes in our work, we can just get tired and worn out and disinterested. How did you just stay, you know, interested? And how did you just look at this stuff and say, wow, this is amazing. What could I do with it? Like, where did you draw your own personal motivation for this to see the bigger picture, to think differently, and to look at your work and say, this is fun?
That's a great question. Well, I, the first thing I think of is that I have a really bad memory. And so unless I'm using some concept, I forget it. So a great example is longitude. We always have to teach longitude in fourth grade. And I just, it's so hard to figure out. I can kind of intuit how you could get latitude, because you could measure the angle of wherever you are with the sun. And I could imagine charts that, okay, if the sun is this high, then it's you're at that place. But to measure longitude when I have no physical clues anywhere around, so then you have to figure it out, and you see, oh, I need two clocks, and one has to be at the time when I started, and then I'm going to measure the sun. And I just have to figure it out. And it's so exciting when I figure it out, you know, that I just can't wait to go and let my kids discover it. My problem is I just want to go in and tell them, but I have to create an experience where they get to kind of discover it. But I do that out of my passion of having discovered it. And then the next year comes and it's time to teach latitude. And I go, oh God, how does latitude work? And I have to figure it out all again. So I'm constantly enthused because I just forget everything and then have to recreate it for myself. So it's one of my disabilities that serves me well in terms of enthusiasm.
That's correct. So you know, let me ask this kind of, you know, maybe a final question or so. And I've learned this from you, and it is, I mean, you've been recognized for your quality and for your effectiveness and you know, as a teacher, as an educator. We don't celebrate that well in our profession with others or for others. How did you take some of those lessons and really build that into celebrations of learning that you've talked about with me before, and that, you know, for students that they get to do, you know, going back to the audience question, that they get to do a public celebration of their own learning and of their own work. You know, so correlate maybe your own experience, but then also the experience of how you tried to create these places for students to really embrace the opportunity to celebrate what they've done.
Great. So the best celebrations are of both the work that they've done and the character that they've employed in order to achieve it. So I think celebrations with kids are always about, here's the beauty of the work and here's what I learned about myself, about my world, about my God through the work that I've done. So those are nothing more powerful than that. And to share that with an audience of significance that cares. Personally, winning awards as a teacher does not win you any friends. I remember I had a chance to speak to all the principals of Massachusetts. So it was a principal meeting, and it was a year I was teacher of the year, and I'm looking at them, and I just said, you know, I have to tell you, being named teacher of the year, you know, everybody cheers and great, but it doesn't really win you friends. It more separates you. It's more your failures that bring you together with people than your successes, which tend to separate you. But I had a softball game last night, and in my softball game, last inning, Vic gets a hit two-run score, we win the game. And the entire bench is just leaping up and hugging each other, and everybody's around to hug Vic when he comes around. And there was no sense of sort of inner sort of competitions or, oh, I wish I would have got that hit. Or it was just pure celebration because what he did was so clearly for the team. So principals, here's your question. Like, what do you do to make your faculty more like my softball team than this sort of balkanized land where every teacher is individually in their own classroom, you know, cordial with one another, but not really feeling they're part of a team working together? It was also when I received the strange Joe Oakey Award, which was really from Autodesk. He was just their representative of their foundation. And the speaker before me, the main speaker actually, was Alfie Cohn. So I think they, first they presented me with this award, and I gave this a little talk, and then Alfie Cohn was the main speaker, and he got up. And at one point, he's written a lot about the sort of the dangerous sort of underbelly of these awards. And at one point, he said, you know, if you do want to do anything to wreck the teaching profession, you know, continue to give out these awards of Teacher of the Year. And I'm sitting there just holding on to my little trophy they gave me, and I'm thinking, oh God, this is. And finally, in the middle of his speech, I actually walked up onto the stage and handed it back to him because he had been the one that presented it to me. And I said, I really guess I shouldn't have this. And it was this wonderful moment. He was like, so he had no idea what I was taught, what we were doing. And then it finally dawned on him. And then he goes, oh, don't bite the hand that feeds you. I see. And so I don't know. I think you have to be cautious. I think if you do, if you are recognized, you just feel so humble because you know, even in your own school, three teachers who were better than you at this and that and that. And there's some, and you also, I mean, the best people who are honored are always ones who all the light that is shined on them, they just reflect on to all the all others. And I think that's what I've tried to do when I've been recognized for something is how to, that light that wants to shine on me, how do I reflect it onto all the people around me who are doing wonderful things and shine a light on just the great work and the challenges of trying to be a teacher in this age.
So as we close up, Stephen, I really appreciate your time. And I love these conversations. I've been blessed by them. But as you in your work and as you travel and as you look at our profession now, what gets you really excited or what's something that you're wondering about or discovering today as you kind of continue to work with teachers and schools and, you know, deeper learning and the EL stuff that you're doing?
Yeah, great. I think a lot of what I'm doing now is trying to recognize the truth that was behind much of, I think, what we did in the secular organization, Expeditionary Learning. And if it's truth, then if it's true, then it's God's truth. There isn't any other. And so trying to sort of reframe the instructional practices, the curriculum possibilities, the assessments that we do, to sort of recast it that so it lives within the story of God, that it lives within the imagination of why we're doing this is because we are created in his image and because this is how he's made us and this is how we co-work with him to restore a fallen and broken world. So trying to reframe some of those, it's the same practices and it's the same assessment structures, but to see its implications for what it means for the story of being in God's kingdom. So that's exciting to me personally and challenging. Another thing we talked about a little before was this idea of how you keep your own wonder and excitement for the work alive. And so, I mean, I love to work with teachers around this idea of you are what you teach. And if you are teaching, so kids always know the difference between when you are kind of moralizing at them and when you are talking out of who you really are. And so helping teachers to sort of recognize their own hypocrisies that we all have of things that we say and do, but we don't really live in our own lives. So somehow creating conditions where it's safe to talk about how we stand up against those values that our school claims we expect of all of our kids, and how are we working on those and demonstrating those for wonder and excitement about learning about the world. How are we manifesting those and practicing those with one another? And then lastly, I think going back to that question again in my own teaching, I just always, and this I think was a curse as well as a blessing, but I just always had to do something different because I couldn't do the same things over and over. So that's why the river was so helpful, because I did have what was stationary, which is when I got to my topics, I knew what I was going to do. I have that in my bank, my teaching bank, but how I was going to get there was always a different adventure, whether it would be through building, through farming, through studying a bicycle, through wool. I gave them a raw fleece of wool and they had to figure out how that became an article of cloth. So like doing real stuff and then connecting it to those is what would keep me alive. And I think trying to work with teachers in ways to remind them of their calling and get them out of the sort of daily pressures that come from the sort of rigors of either Common Core in the public system or just cognitive development, which is so deeply influencing what we think we're always supposed to be doing, is something that I love to do.
Well, Stephen, thank you for your time today. Love talking with you. Look forward to connecting with you again soon.
All right. Thanks, Eric.